Good morning. So today we are continuing our series called Life Goals. We started it last week, Matt kicked off, and this is based on the fruit of the Spirit listed in Galatians 5, 22 to 23. It says, "But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness and self-control. Against such things there is no law." So each week at the moment we're taking a different one of these attributes and we're looking at what the Bible teaches us about it and why it deserves to be a life goal. And today we're talking about joy. Joy is one of those difficult to define words. It's kind of related to happiness or pleasure, but it's also distinctly different from that. A dictionary definition that I quite like is intense gladness. But then even with that, you know, you've got to kind of then define things more. At Breakfast Church, we had a discussion about this, and June had a great description I liked. She said she described it as like a warm hug from her grandchildren. I loved that, like a warm blanket wrapping around you. But really, it is very difficult to fully sum up the idea of joy in a sentence. There's lots of different sources of short-lived temporary joy. I mean, seeing a baby giggling, or a beautiful sunrise, or a wonderful meal, or your family. Sometimes. But for me, all the time. But the Bible teaches us of an eternal joy, a fullness of joy, a deep well of salvation that never runs dry. And finding this source of joy means that your source of joy is not just what's in front of you right now. It's not what you're seeing and appreciating right now, but it's more detached from your circumstances. It means it's possible to truly and sincerely say every day, "This is the day that the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it." Sometimes it's hard to say that sincerely and truthfully. But when we find that deep source of joy, we're able to say that. And that's what we're going to explore today, how to find that joy. Now, I want to start with a quote on joy from the author Eugene Peterson, from his excellent book with a title that I think is a sermon in itself, "A Long Obedience in the Same Direction, Discipleship in an Instant Society." Now, interestingly, this came out in 1980, but I think we're far more of an instant society now than we were then. So it's got a lot of wisdom for us. It's a bit of a lengthy quote, but I think it's worth it. It says, "We try to get it through entertainment. We pay someone to make jokes, tell stories, perform dramatic actions, sing songs. We buy the vitality of another's imagination to divert and enliven our own poor lives. The enormous entertainment industry in our land is a sign of the depletion of joy in our culture. Society is a bored, gluttonous king, employing a court jester to divert it after an overindulgent meal. But that kind of joy never penetrates our lives, never changes our basic constitution. The effects are extremely temporary. A few minutes, a few hours, a few days at most. When we run out of money, the joy trickles away. We cannot make ourselves joyful. Joy cannot be commanded, purchased, or arranged. But there is something we can do. We can decide to live in response to the abundance of God and not under the dictatorship of our own poor needs. We can decide to live in the environment of a living God and not our own dying selves. We can decide to center ourselves in the God who generously gives and not in our own egos which greedily grab." It's a great quote, isn't it? And what a killer last line that is as well. Joy is when we decide to live in a response to God's abundance, in response to his abundant presence, his abundant goodness, his abundant mercy, his abundant life. Do you know and experience all of that right now, in the here and now? Maybe not, but my hope is that today, as every other day, we come to know that a bit more. And the main passage we're reading today is Psalm 126. It's a short psalm, just six verses. It's not known exactly who the author of this psalm is or what the precise historical context was, but it's clearly written in reference to one of the Israelite exiles, where the Israelites were conquered and exiled into a foreign land. And it refers to God having set them free and done good things for them. So I'm going to read the whole psalm, first of all. It says, "When the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dreamed. Our mouths were filled with laughter, our tongues with songs of joy. Then it was said among the nations, 'The Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us. We are filled with joy.' Restore our fortunes, Lord, like streams in the Negev. Like those who sow with tears will reap with songs of joy. Those who go out weeping, carrying seed to sow, will return with songs of joy." Now we can break this psalm into two parts. The first three verses are about what God has done for his people. It's gratitude, it's remembering. The second three verses are where they're asking him to do something again. Now, all of us here, I'm sure, have experienced unanswered prayers in the past. I'm also sure that all of us here today have probably, hopefully, experienced answered prayers as well. And here's a challenge for you, or a suggestion for you. Keep a notebook or a document where you note down things that God has done for you, prayers that he has answered for you. That in itself is a source of joy, but it's also a source of hope and faith when you come to ask for something else. And one of the purposes of the Psalms was to teach God's people their story, where God had acted and been faithful in the past. And it's good to know our own too. Now, the Israelites were recalling how they felt when they were returned to their homeland after years in exile. This is a picture for us of salvation, being set free from captivity and being restored into God's presence. It says when God restored their fortunes, they were like those who dreamed. Have you ever had a moment in your life like that, where everything just seems right? You're floating like 2 feet above the ground. You're walking on sunshine, maybe singing it as well. It's like those who dream. That's joy for you. It says our mouths were filled with laughter and our tongues with songs of joy. That is an appropriate reaction to understanding the gospel, that God in his mercy and his goodness has set you free. Laughter and joy. The American novelist Ellen Glasgow, in her autobiography, says of her strict Presbyterian father, "In his long life, he never committed a pleasure." That can be the reputation Christians can have sometimes. Joy stealing, fun dampening, laughter silencing bores. And sometimes maybe we even earn that reputation. Now, it would be easy for me to say now, well, of course that's not true. We know the source of all joy. Okay, but would anybody else know? Or is that joy so deep, 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 deep down in your heart that it's never actually seen the light of day? Laughter and songs of joy, those things are seen and they're heard and they're noticed. Now, we all have different emotional kind of constitutions and personalities. It doesn't look the same for everybody. But I think there's something in that for all of us in terms of how we express ourselves. And in fact, the very next line in the psalm, it says, "Then it was said among the nations, 'The Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us, and we are filled with joy.'" The nations noticed. The nations saw in the way that they lived the joy that they had experienced in the goodness of God. Sounds great, doesn't it? All this goodness, if only it was that simple. We'd have a revival here every week as people see that Christians are richer and healthier and more successful and fulfilled and happier. Nothing to cry about, just laughter and songs of joy 24/7. But is that our reality? Not quite. But this passage continues, and it brings a bit of depth into what started off sounding unrelentingly and maybe unrealistically positive. It says, "Restore our fortunes, Lord, like streams in the Negev. Those who sow with tears will reap with songs of joy. Those who go out weeping, carrying seed to sow, will return with songs of joy, carrying sheaves with them." And as I said earlier, this is referring to one of the times they had been exiled, so they'd been set free. But what becomes clear here is that despite the unrelenting happiness of the first half, everything is not fine for them. They still have things that they're asking God to do. They're still looking to God to find joy in their circumstances. Now, what are the streams in the Negev? What's that strange little line about there? This is referring to dried up riverbeds that would occasionally flood when there was rain up in the mountains. It would come down and it would flood those plains. And the water would bring life and abundance to an area that was once barren. Now, this is a transition that's being described here of dry barrenness to abundant fruitfulness, all in the same place. It's not the barren place and the fruitful place. It's the barren place becoming fruitful. And then verse 5 and 6 talk about weeping as you sow, but singing when you reap. Another transition of life. And this might seem strange to modern ears, but this sowing and reaping imagery, of course, was very familiar to the people reading this at the time. But both, obviously, in a literal sense, in that they were living off the land, reaping what they sowed. But it was also a familiar image to them spiritually as well, in their spiritual traditions. And in fact, it's one that we see woven all throughout Scripture as well. And one really significant passage we see is in John 12, where Jesus uses this imagery as he's starting to prepare his disciples for the fact that he's going to die. John 12, 23 to 24, "But Jesus replied, 'The hour has come. Truly, truly, I tell you, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a seed. But if it dies, it bears much fruit.'" Jesus was the seed that was going to die, but through the sorrow of his death was going to come much fruit. Fruit that could not be born in any other way than the seed falling to the ground and dying. That seed had to be planted in the ground for that plant to grow. And in Hebrews 12, verse 2, it says, "Looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of God." Here we have it again, joy found on the other side of suffering. Not joy in the suffering. Jesus wasn't taking joy in the fact that he was being tortured and killed on the cross. Rather, he was able to endure that suffering because he knew with absolute certainty that joy lay on the other side of it. And that's something that we as Christians, we can grow in an awareness of whenever we are suffering, whenever we are going through different trials, a transition into joy is possible. Weeping may last through the night, but joy comes in the morning. That's Psalm 30, verse 5. Later in the same chapter, "You returned for me my mourning into dancing." The theologian Henri Nouwen says, "Mourning and dancing are part of the same movement of grace." In other words, it's often not one or the other, but through the power of the cross, we see joy grows out of the soil of loss and suffering. It's all a movement of grace. The joy of coming out of exile and into freedom. The joy of the dry, barren land being refreshed and brought to life by the streams from the mountains. The joy of seeds going down into the ground and providing an abundance of harvest. The joy of Jesus's death and resurrection, bringing many sons and daughters to glory. Where is this source of joy? What makes it possible for joy to come out of suffering and loss? In Isaiah 12, in part of a long passage prophesying the coming reign of Jesus, it says in verse 3, with joy in these days you will draw water from the well of salvation. Isaiah 25, verse 6 says, then will the lame leap like a deer and the mute tongue shout for joy. Water will gush forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. Jeremiah 31, verse 12 says, they will come and shout for joy on the heights of Zion. They will rejoice in the bounty of the Lord, the grain, the new wine and the olive oil, the young of the flocks and the herds. They will be like a well-watered garden and they will sorrow no more. Streams in the Negev, water gushing in the desert, well-watered garden, deep wells of salvation. Are you getting the picture here? True joy, intense gladness. This comes not because our circumstances are necessarily good, but because regardless of the circumstances we see ahead of us, we're sustained and transformed by the life-giving waters of the Spirit of God. It takes that seed of the gospel that is within us and it bursts into life, our mourning into a dancing, our sorrows into shouts of joy. Joy comes because the seed of all that we have laid down, all that we have lost, all that we have mourned and wept over is bursting into life. It's budding into blossom. It's bearing abundant fruit. It comes when we center ourselves in God's abundance rather than our lack. Those who went out weeping, they returned with songs of joy. It's all the same movement of grace. I lived for 11 years in Oman, a very hot and barren but beautiful country in the Arabian Peninsula. And one summer, I headed off on an adventure of a lifetime with two friends. One friend from the church I was part of there, and the other one being the vicar of the Anglican church in Muscat. And our destination was this huge cave system hidden in the mountains where we intended to hike to and camp the night in the cave. We had to drive up a precipitous mountain track, leave the vehicle, then hike for 3 hours with all of our provisions, following goat paths into a valley where we eventually found this cave. And we spent an incredible night there, sat round a fire, prayed together, shared a cold tub of biryani and a whiskey. A truly memorable night, definitely a hashtag joy moment. But what became even more memorable was the following morning, where we made a series of misjudgments. Firstly, because it was cool in the cave, we spent a little too long there before setting off, which meant that too much of the 3-hour hike back was under the direct blaring sun with temperatures fast exceeding 40 degrees C. Next mistake was the navigation one. The route there was fairly clear as many paths kind of merged into one, all leading into the same valley. But doing that in reverse, it was easy to take the wrong fork. And that's exactly what we did. Worst of all, it transpired that the good vicar of Muscat had not brought nearly enough water with him. And so the other two of us who had brought plenty of water ended up, we had to share it all out between us. And we didn't have enough for all three of us. And we quickly ran out of water. So it left us without water, no idea where the car was, no phone signal or navigation device, and absolutely sweltering temperatures and a big pack on our back. Now, the next period of time was a bit of a blur. I remember at one point taking a mouthful of trail mix to try and give myself some energy, but my mouth was so dry that it was like chewing gravel. I couldn't swallow it, but I couldn't also spit it out either because it was just kind of stuck there in my mouth. I felt simultaneously lightheaded, but also like my feet were made out of concrete. It's probably the closest I've come to having an out-of-body experience. But eventually we spotted the track, which of course gave us a boost. But we were saying, well, when we get there, is it up the track or down the track to get the car? We're not getting to it at quite the same point. But fortunately, as we got closer to it, we could see that the car wasn't too far along. And in the car, there was a treasure that we were all waiting for, because we'd left a cool box there full of ice blocks and cold water. And I can't tell you the joy, the intense gladness that we felt taking a long, deep swig from a bottle of ice-cold water, feeling it as it ran down our throat, refreshing our body from the inside out, and then pouring it over our dusty, burnt heads. 10 minutes later, we're rehydrated, air-conditioned, and descending back down the mountain road towards home. I can't remember if there were songs of joy, but our mouths were certainly filled with laughter as we reminisced about our near-death experience. But that moment of joy only existed because of the trials that we'd just been through. If we'd had an easy, event-free stroll back to the car, I wouldn't even remember that part of the adventure, let alone be telling you the story today. Sometimes the journey that we're on becomes a real trial. That's life. We go through all kinds of difficulties. We can lose our way. We can become spiritually dehydrated. We can become weighed down by the burdens that we carry, unable to cope with the heat of the situation. Even good things can feel like gravel in our mouth that we just can't consume. You might say, where's the joy in that moment? And truthfully, there might not be any joy through the night, though. But joy comes in the morning. Joy comes out of these situations. But for the joy set before you, you can endure. And it's in these moments that the deepest, truest, most lasting joy can emerge. Sometimes that joy comes like waters flowing over the Negev, or like me reaching the car and downing a cold bottle of water. It's fast and it's sudden and it's life-changing. Other times we're drawing deep from the well of salvation. It's routine, it's normal, but it's essential sustenance, helping that fruit of joy to grow in your life. Because it is a fruit. It may affect your emotions, but it's not an emotion. It may affect your feelings, but it's not a feeling. It's a fruit. And fruit is the natural produce of a healthy seed in fertile soil. It's a movement of grace from death to life. Now let's get really practical, because there's lots of things that would attempt to steal your joy. And it's tempting to shortcut joy as well. Fruit takes time to grow, time to ripen. We're not a patient culture. We're an instant society. And even worse, we have all of these counterfeiters of joy in our pockets now. You can open your Instagram app or Snapchat app or whatever it is that you might use, and you can see endless streams of things that the algorithm thinks will bring you a little hit of joy. Whether that's giggling babies or cartwheeling kittens or scantily clad fitness influencers or know-it-all political pundits, whatever you hover over for slightly longer than other things, it's going to feed you more and more of that until you're left anaesthetized in a trance, wondering where that last hour went. I think most of us here probably can relate to that every now and then. You can spend hours scrolling through other people's impressive lives and achievements, leaving you dull and despondent, feeling like your life is completely inadequate. There's a perverse type of abundance here. Not the abundance of God, but an abundant reminder of your lack. Not the abundance of community, but the abundance of connections without relationship. Abundance that doesn't spiritually awaken us to eternal truths, but slowly suffocates us with untruths. This is something that we all have to wrestle with today. Ask questions like, is our self-control stronger than the algorithm? Is it time to delete the app? Does the positive outweigh the negative? Is it robbing you of a true source of joy? Now, these are personal questions. It won't be the same answer to everyone, but they're questions we must take seriously if we're to guard our source of true joy. Now, we can even do this in a religious way. I remember in my last church, someone proudly telling our home group that she listens to 5 or 6 sermons a week. And that sounds very holy. But consumption of Christian content, whether it's celebrity preacher sermons or Christian social media influences, whilst not always bad, can sometimes get in the way of having a personal, authentic relationship with God within a community of believers that you actually know. Now, I'm not saying this is an exact ratio, but it's probably better for your discipleship and apprenticeship to Jesus to spend 15 minutes praying and reading the Bible yourself or with friends than an hour consuming Christian content. And before you wonder, what about now? Sat listening to someone talk about God? The difference is here, you're in a real community. We know each other to some extent. We can talk to one another. We can challenge one another. May not be as polished or professional as YouTube can deliver, but it's part of community formation rather than a one-way media empire. Whether it's your Christian discipleship or your social life, always prioritize the in-person, or to use a theological term, the incarnate. Something we see throughout the Bible is a deep appreciation of community and history. In Psalm 126, they were recalling their community stories. They weren't actually talking at all about their individual ones. They were basing their hope and for the future on their knowledge of God's faithfulness in the past. Scripture invites us to zoom out on our life. There's where we are now, right now, in this exact second, with the troubles of today, the things on our mind, probably half listening to what I'm saying, half thinking about what's on the table for lunch or whatever else is troubling you. We can zoom back a bit from that and we can see our past and our future. We can see our direction of travel. We can see that we're not where we used to be. We can zoom back further and we can see the community of people that are around us and the stories that they have, the difficulties they're going through, and also their examples and stories of God's faithfulness. We can zoom back even further and we can see the worldwide community of believers, all brothers and sisters in Christ. We can zoom back further still and we see, like the author of Hebrews, the heroes of faith throughout history cheering us on. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Church, we may be insignificant as individuals, as even a body of people here. We might feel we don't really matter a great deal, but we have all been called into a story that is infinitely bigger and more glorious than we can imagine. A story that is nothing less than the reconciliation of all things. It's not easy to comprehend. It's not easy to always keep this in mind, but the more we learn and reflect on the bigger picture, the easier it is to experience joy, no matter what we're going through, no matter what the circumstances. It's that long obedience in the same direction. It's not those instant moments, as precious as they can be from time to time, as important as they can be from time to time. It's that long journey that we have, and it's finding joy within that. Now I'm going to invite the musicians back up and they're going to lead us in some worship, but I want to close, before I do hand over to them, with a few bullet points, because I think something that is essential in all of this is about how we keep the soil of our soul rich and fertile, how we keep it watered. And there's a number of things we can do that really kills it. So there's a few kind of do's and don'ts or suggestions here that I want to just go through. One is, don't obsessively follow the news. I don't mean here be uninformed, but there is such an abundance of it now. We can be continually engaged in that with no end in sight. And this is a challenge very much for me. I'm somebody that gets very tempted to do that. But that can be a thief of your joy. And you can get all kind of het up over things that actually you can do absolutely nothing about. Don't be a slave to social media. Is it time to radically reduce or even eliminate things from your life? Do prioritize in-person relationships and hospitality. This is where joy really comes, when you are together with other people, connection with other people. Do take risks. What's God calling you to? So many moments of joy come from the times when it was really difficult and you don't know what you're going to do. But sometimes we live our life trying to avoid those times when we don't know what we're going to do because we play it safe. Sometimes it's good to take risks. And finally, no, not finally, second to finally, slow down. Wasn't the best joke, was it? Second to finally, slow down, enjoy God's creation. There are so many sources of joy that we can tap into when we just allow ourselves to be present where we are. We're so blessed here in Worthing to be able to walk down to the sea and just look out into that infinite mass of water and just experience that power there. But how often do we slow down and appreciate it? And now, truly, finally, be a spreader of joy to others. Joy is something that should be seen. Joy is something that should be visible, not buried deep, deep, deep down in our heart. We need to remember to tell our face sometimes. A smile, an encouragement, a positive word, a gift. What can you do to bring joy to other people? I'm going to leave it there and hand back to Josh and the band. Thank you.